تيزدد لم يمت حتى يركبه. The man who imputes dishonor to a Muslim for a matter will not die before that matter is stuck to him. You know, when you dishonor someone for that, for example, thing that is mistakenly happened to that person, be sure that you will not die unless that things come to you, happen to you as well. So that's why beware of not dishonoring the people, the Muslims, for some matters. It is narrated from the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam that my nation, my followers, should be always cautious and careful about these sort of things. Thank you very much. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Rouhani in the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
This one lay.
Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Several international agencies are confirming the dire situation in Gaza. According to Save the Children organization, all 1.1 million children in Gaza are facing death by starvation or disease. The World Food Program stopped aid deliveries to the north because of security concerns and talked about the unprecedented levels of desperation. And the UN says that 2.3 million people in Gaza are on the brink of starvation. So what do these warnings mean if nothing is done and young and old are being starved to death as the world watches the genocidal regime of the Zionists and their Western partners continue to kill more Palestinians? But I'd like to welcome my guests to this program. Out of Moscow, former CIA analyst Larry Johnson. And out of Vermont, research and political analyst Christopher Hilali.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with us on this spotlight. It started off in Moscow. And Larry, how is it that these international agencies can witness the dire situation and even issue warnings about it but do nothing? I mean, what good are the organizations unless there are enforcements, they're able to enforce it?
Yeah, no, I agree. It's truly shocking. What we're seeing is something that's akin to what happened to Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto and in the Lodz ghettos during World War II. And you would think the Jews who went through that, or at least the ancestors of those who went through that, would have some measure of compassion, some measure of humanity. And instead, they're doing the same thing that the Nazis did to the Jews, shutting off access to food. You had images during World War II of these children dying and starving in the streets. Well, you're seeing that now. And the problem with, particularly for the Palestinian children, children are very fragile. You know, I worked my way through college as a respiratory therapy tech. And what we learned back then is that children can get sick and go downhill very, very quickly. So it's important that they have adequate nutrition, that they have that they are properly fed, they are, have adequate access to water. And the fact that Israel is denying them that willfully, knowingly, and the rest of the world, with the exception of the Houthis. The Houthis are the only country that's actually fighting back, trying to take action to compel Israel to impose a ceasefire and stop killing the Palestinians.
Okay, well, Christopher, your opinion that the world is watching the Israeli regime use starvation as a weapon of war, which is a war crime. So what is supposed to happen next with this information? Let's say in this little perfect world, what is supposed to happen at this point? Okay, they're using starvation as a weapon of war, which is a war crime. What happens next?
In an ideal world, the entire Israeli government and all the Israeli military officers and non-commissioned officers would be before an international tribunal for war crimes, just like in Nuremberg or in Japan after the Second World War. But of course, we sadly don't live in a perfect world. We await one, but we don't have one yet. And so as we continue to struggle, we realize that all of these crimes that we are witnessing, war crimes of a horrific magnitude, are happening and unfolding before our eyes. And many of the international institutions and structures are powerless in the face of such devastation and such crimes. And so really, what can we do? The only thing that can be done is the continuing pressure from outside by foreign governments, by populations that are using the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, the BDS movement, to continue to pressure their governments, their institutions, the corporations that they buy from, their pension funds, to divest wholly from the Zionist entity, to completely cut off relations with the State of Israel, and to pressure their powers that they have control over to enact some type of change. But you know, with all of that not happening yet, or happening at a very slow pace, we sadly are witness to this spectacle of carnage and genocide before us, and are relatively powerless. Of course, we know that the Houthis are fighting, Hezbollah is fighting, many other groups are trying to do what they can. But given the relationship of the Zionist state with the United States and with its Western partners and allies, it's very difficult to bring justice at this point. But we believe justice will prevail at some point. The question is when.
Okay. Well, Larry, as the regime commits these unbelievable crimes every day in Gaza and in the West Bank, it is also experiencing growing pressure from within. Your thoughts on that? Do you think that the dissension that is happening inside of the Israeli regime will help lead to its implosion?
No, unfortunately. I think what it's going to take, and what we've seen is Israel has withdrawn a lot of its combat brigades from Gaza, shifted them a little bit out of the West Bank, and deployed them north on the border with Lebanon and Syria. I anticipate, as per predictions by General Halevi of the Israeli occupation force and by public opinion polls in Israel, that they're going to launch an offensive operation into Lebanon to take on Hezbollah. This is insane on the part of Israel. It's one of the stupidest things they could do. But the irony is it may be end up turning into the salvation of the Palestinian people, because Israel is likely to be defeated and defeated decisively if they do this. And
let me just jump in here with what you're saying. So you believe at this point in time or soon that the regime is going to turn more of its attention to the north and attack Lebanon directly. They want to take on Hezbollah. What do you think it thinks that it can accomplish by doing that?
They're delusional. They didn't pay attention to what happened in 2006. Heavens, they didn't even pay attention to what happened in 1982. You know, they were responsible for the massacres at Sabra and Shatila, the refugee camps there. But Hezbollah is a real army. Hezbollah is not a collection of sandal-wearing, green headscarf guys that are running around ad hoc. They're an actual formidable military force. Israel, in its hubris and in its arrogance, believes that it can attack Hezbollah and prevail. I believe that that is wrong. I believe that the Israelis will discover the hard way that Hezbollah is a credible military force, perhaps one of the best military forces in the Middle East today. Israel is not a good military force, as we've seen by their conduct in Gaza and in the West Bank. They are undisciplined. They are untrained. They are a group of reservists that occupy, that react more to emotion than according to professional military standards. Hezbollah, ironically, though characterized as a terrorist force, is in fact a much more competent, professional military force, and they're likely to crush the Israeli invasion. That, when Israel is facing certain military defeat, it will be that which will provide the opening for a genuine negotiated settlement where Israel will have to forego its desire to exterminate the Palestinians.
Interesting analysis. Christopher, your thoughts on what Larry just said.
I think Larry is correct. I do believe accurately, as he has pointed out, Hezbollah is not only a capable fighting force, but they have had combat experience over the past decade fighting against these Salafi and Wahhabi groups in Syria, supporting the Syrian government in Damascus, fighting, waging a struggle against these U.S.-backed forces that were there, whether it be Islamic State, al-Nusra, and all of the other alphabet soup of groups that were over there. Really, what it is now is you have Hezbollah, not only a formidable military force, but a formidable with a formidable military arsenal, with technological capabilities, with advanced weaponry, and with the capabilities to strike not only the border, but deep into Israeli territory. And so I think that this is critical for us to recognize that the entering of Hezbollah into this war fully, not as it has been, very cautiously and, one strike at this base, one strike at that base. We're talking about an all-out war here, if that's what happens, as my colleague points out. If that does happen, the Israeli military is no match for Hezbollah, not only in terms of head-to-head, but the asymmetric warfare, which they are not ready and capable to handle at this point. It is not, some roadside bombs. This is going to be a full-on struggle that they have not really dealt with in many decades.
Okay. Well, Larry, as the Israeli regime continues to target infants and kids, the Palestinian resistance continues to target Zionist soldiers and equipment. Your assessment of the resistance now, almost 5 months into this genocide?
Well, Israel claimed that their initial goal was to eliminate Hamas. You know, I could understand that at the outset of this military operation by Israel, if they had strictly targeted Hamas fighters, they might have had a chance of bringing in some support from governments like Turkey, Saudi Arabia, if they confined themselves to that. But they revealed their hand. This is not about fighting or defeating Hamas. This is about destroying the Palestinian people. And it doesn't matter whether they're Muslim or Christian. The Israelis are intent on killing, destroying all Palestinians. There is no reason, justification, excuse in the world to explain the deaths of these children and these mothers that has just become the daily story out of Gaza and to a lesser extent in the West Bank. So Israel has disgraced itself. It has lost whatever moral authority it might have pretended to exert. And, you know, I am sad to see it, but it is incumbent upon the world to condemn this genocide, because that's what it is. This is not a justified military operation responding against particular attackers. This is collective punishment, and that is not right under any regime in the world, be they a monarchy, a democracy, whatever. There's no justification or excuse for this.
Well, Christopher, there's shelling of displaced families. There's little water or food. There's no medical aid. And basically no break for the Palestinian people and no place safe there. And the regime continues to attack. I mean, do you agree with Larry said, is the goal of this regime to kill every Palestinian?
The goal has always been to kill every Palestinian, to wipe the land clean. You know, the mythology that this was a land without a people can only come to pass in reality if the Palestinians are extinguished from their land. And this has been the rallying cry of the far right in Israel for many decades. This is not new. What is new is this situation where now you have these very fascistic leaders in power. Here I'm thinking of Ben-Gvir and Smotrich in particular, and their political parties and their allies, of course, who have it as a stated goal that from the sea to the river is only Jewish territory. It's only for the Jewish people. There should be nobody else there. And that doesn't only mean Muslims. It means Christians as well. It means other minorities as well. And so the stated goal is nothing Palestinian to remain on that land. And so this attack on October 7th provided the perfect opportunity to carry out this operation, which they might not have been able to do without this happening. And so now with it in full effect, we're witnessing right before our eyes, they're not simply targeting Hamas. And as my colleague said, I think that if they had done that, they would have had a little bit more support from some countries that have now turned against them. They are destroying every house, every building, every piece of infrastructure, everything that they can hit, they are hitting, with the stated goal of, we will allow for emigration. We will allow you to leave. We will give you any documents you need. But they know that once they leave, they're not coming back. Just like after the Nakba, the 750,000 plus Palestinians who left, who were forced to leave, who were evicted from their land, have not returned. That's what's happening today. And that's what we are recognizing. That's why people are saying this is genocide, because it is the cleansing of the Palestinians from their land. And the problem is how to stop, Israel from carrying out this fully. And you've recognized that it's very difficult to do because the U.S. has protected it for so long, and because Israel is an illegal nuclear power, and this provides the cover and protection that it so desires.
So what are you saying there with the, Christopher, just staying with you, what you just said at the end about being a nuclear power? Do you think that the regime would use that to threaten, for example, I don't know, the Americans or whom? Tell me what you mean by that.
What I mean is that it's very hard to displace the Israeli regime, that Israel's only salvation is the fact that it's a nuclear power, that if it had not been a nuclear power, that I think many armies would have gone in and would have dismantled this fascist state. Okay. But sadly, because it's a nuclear power, that's its only saving grace by which it holds the saber over its neighbors and the region and says, nobody can touch us, no matter how many genocides we commit, we will reserve the right to use these nuclear weapons. That's the danger of this Zionist entity.
Okay, well, Larry, how much longer do you think these Western governments and their regional puppets can do nothing about this everyday suffering and destruction taking place in Gaza?
Unfortunately, it's all under the Israeli timetable. They're going to launch an invasion into southern Lebanon. I think that's pretty certain. The timing of it remains unknown. Once they do that, whatever initial success they might have, might think they have, it's going to crumble. Hezbollah is going to defeat the armored columns that the Israelis try to insert. And then they're going to launch counterstrikes. Hezbollah has missiles that can penetrate deep into Israel that are they haven't used really up to this point. And so they will then cause significant mass casualties in Israel proper. At that point, that is going to put the government of Benjamin Netanyahu into complete chaos because they will have provoked a fight that they're not capable of winning. And even with nuclear weapons, they can threaten to use nuclear weapons at that point, but this is like launching nukes at a point-blank range where it would do as much damage to Israel as it could potentially to Hezbollah or anybody else. So, we're talking a horrific scenario. There is this kind of death and destruction is so needless, so useless. And yet, I personally cannot erase the images of these children, of these women, of these families who are mourning their dead and who are trying to escape the violence, and yet Israel continues to inflict it upon them, and they're not carrying firearms, they're not carrying bombs, they're not carrying missiles. It's inhuman, it's unjust.
Yes, I think it's affected, as you said, it's inhuman, and it has affected the psyche of anyone humane in this world by this time. Well, Christopher, what has the regime accomplished with this Holocaust from a military perspective?
They've accomplished nothing. Really, they've accomplished nothing in terms of their stated goals. What they have accomplished is destroying all the infrastructure, killing 35,000+ Palestinians and displacing them. But in terms of a strategic goal or aims or victory, like they're trying to say, they really haven't accomplished anything. In fact, they've made the situation far worse for themselves because now they've isolated themselves politically. They've isolated themselves in terms of the world stage. And now, of course, they are in a predicament because now they've destroyed all this infrastructure. And now what's going to happen? They're going to leave almost 2 million Palestinians in Gaza without houses, without water, without fuel, without electricity. For how long? How long will the international community stand for this? And so what people are saying and what many commentators are rightfully pointing out is that this pressure will eventually bring down the government of Netanyahu, most likely. Mm. And what comes next is a government that either will have to take responsibility for the plight of the Palestinians in Gaza and try to open up and loosen the restrictions that have been on Gaza, or they will go in the opposite direction and further isolate themselves and further add fire and fuel to this situation. But I think that this Holocaust, this genocide that we're witnessing cannot go on for much longer without serious consequences for Israel on the international stage and domestically within Israel society. We watched those videos just over the past few days of clashes in many of the cities in Israel and many protesters calling for the ousting of Netanyahu. I think Israeli society is boiling as well. What that looks like will show what the future looks like for the people in Gaza and for the people in the region.
Well, Larry, the regime has said that whatever it does, it's to protect the Israeli regime's security, which obviously almost an oxymoron. But in general, do you think that this regime now can recover or even survive after becoming the pariah of the world?
I think it's important to recognize that even if Netanyahu goes, despite his toxic nature and his terrible governance, that still the majority of the Israeli population support the policies that he has been following. So even if Benny Gantz, who's considered a liberal in Western standards, comes into office, he is going to advocate some of the same policies about destroying and eliminating Palestinians. So this is not just simply a change in government in Israel is not going to eliminate the threat to the Palestinians. The only thing that's going to eliminate the threat to the Palestinians is a military defeat of the Israeli military. They must suffer a significant defeat in Lebanon, and then it will be at that point that the Muslim nations that surround Israel will at least have some bargaining power to compel Israel to accept the Palestinians, accept a Palestinian state, and not continue to engage in this policy of genocide, which they're going to follow whether it's Netanyahu or Benny Gantz.
Okay. Well, Christopher, I mean, the regime continues to say, as mentioned earlier, that it wanted to destroy Hamas, and of course they haven't been able to do that. On the other hand, would you say that with the crimes that the Zionists have committed against Palestinians, that it has actually become the biggest recruiter for the resistance, that more and more people realize that they have no choice when dealing with this regime except to resist? And we hear stories about many young people today who perhaps they didn't even have that perspective before October the 7th, but they definitely feel that resistance is the only way after losing all of their loved ones and everything that they ever knew.
Absolutely. I think that after the Second Intifada in the 90s and the 2000s, we were, and into the 2010s, we were told, okay, peace, let's give peace a chance. Let's try nonviolent actions. There were many projects and programs, especially in the occupied West Bank, trying to figure out if civil society could move the needle on a just resolution to the ongoing occupation of the Palestinian people. And of course, what this whole, 5 months has proven to us is that armed resistance is the only way to bring the Zionist regime to its knees. That no matter how many demonstrations you do, how many peaceful sit-ins, how many nonviolent actions you do, the Zionists only understand one language, and that's the language of force.
Okay.
So I think here it's necessary to recognize that they have become the greatest recruiter for the axis of resistance in history.
All right. And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me on this spotlight. Larry Johnson, former CIA analyst out of Moscow. Christopher Halali, research and political analyst out of Vermont. And thank you for being with us on another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll discuss some of the contents of chapter Naml, the 27th chapter of the Holy Quran, as well as some of the commentary points of the verses. Dear listeners, let's listen to the fourth and fifth verses of the chapter.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم إن الذين لا يؤمنون بالآخرة زينا لهم أعمالهم فهم يعمهون.
Indeed, for those who do not believe in the hereafter, we have made pleasing to them their deeds, so they wander blindly.
أولئك الذين لهم سوء العذاب وهم في الآخرة هم الأخسرون.
Those are the ones for whom there will be the worst of punishment, and in the hereafter they are the greatest losers.
Regarding these two verses, dear listeners, we mentioned important points in the previous episode. We mentioned the fact that in the third verse, different qualities for mu'minun is mentioned. But in this fourth one, only one of them is negated, and as a result of that, they are being led into being astray, and they are called akhsarun, the greatest losers. Why? And what is that quality? Not believing in hereafter. This is the thing that the akhsarun do not possess. They don't believe in hereafter. They do not have this belief, yet مؤمنون يقيمون الصلاة ويؤتون الزكاة وهم بالآخرة هم يوقنون. They believe in hereafter. They know that hereafter is the right thing. But these أخسرون do not believe in that. And that's why the ornamentation of their deeds is happening. The Almighty Allah makes their ugly deeds fair seeming unto them. زَيَّنَّا لَهُمْ أَعْمَالَهُمْ فَهُمْ يَعْمَهُونَ. They wander bewildered. It means that they are trying to do the best thing they possibly think of. But no, that's not what they think it is. The reality is gone. They do not believe that whatever it is they're doing is the ugly thing, yet they believe this is the right thing. They believe sometimes this is their duty to do so. Anyway, أُولَٰئِكَ الَّذِينَ لَهُمْ سُوءُ الْعَذَابِ. This means that they are for whom shall be a grievous chastisement. Chastisement in the world or hereafter. Which one? The continuation of the verse makes this clear. وَهُمْ فِي الْآخِرَةِ هُمُ الْأَخْسَرُونَ. They are the greatest losers in hereafter. So this means that in the beginning part of the verse, it is the discussion of only this world. Even in this world, they shall have grievous chastisement. What about the next world? وَهُمْ فِي الْآخِرَةِ هُمُ الْأَخْسَرُونَ. They shall be the greatest losers.
على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
in this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
we
approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
حفظ الكتاب بصدره فبدا وضيئا كالنجوم تألقا وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Now, Why is it that they are called the greatest losers? The reason of that they are the greatest losers, أخسرون, is the same thing that is mentioned in chapter Kahf, which announces, say, shall we inform you of the greatest losers? قُلْ هَلْ نُنَبِّئُكُمْ بِالْأَخْسَرِينَ أَعْمَالًا الَّذِينَ ضَلَّ سَعْيُهُمْ فِي الْحَيَاةِ الدُّنْيَا وَهُمْ يَحْسَبُونَ أَنَّهُمْ يُحْسِنُونَ صُنْعًا. Those whose effort is lost in this world's life, while they think that they are working good deeds. This is really, really frightening. May the Almighty Allah keep us away from such a station. May the Almighty Allah help us understand what the reality of our actions and deeds are. What a loss is greater than this one? What a loss can be greater than this? That some people consider their ugly deeds beautiful. They do their best to commit them, thinking that they are in the right path, thinking that they are doing a positive task. But at the end, they see they have provided nothing for themselves but misery and wretchedness in the world and hereafter. Anyway, the losers are of different groups. Khasir is the one whose whole life and capitals are ruined. For example, the Quran says, the losers surely are those who shall have lost themselves and their families on the day of resurrection. There are also the ones who are in loss, the ones who are not a true believer and do not do righteous deeds, the ones who are in state of clear loss, which are the ones who worship Allah not earnestly. And we also have the utmost losers, those who are deviated and think that they are on the right path. We'll discuss more later on, God willing. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
No picket lines over the weekend here, but the strike action is on.
Thousands of National Health Service junior doctors, who form half of the doctors' workforce in England, walk off the job. Their demands the same as the last time we talked to them.
Because of this erosion of pay over all this time, we've been seeing problems with staff recruitment and retention, and we've been hemorrhaging people either out of medicine completely or to other countries that are willing to recruit us and pay us basically the rates we were being paid 15 years ago. And so the message from the BMA has always been to try and get that pay back to 2008 levels.
In other words, a 35% pay rise to make up for previous below-inflation pay rises. An extra 3% on top of the average of nearly 9% received last year was being discussed before talks between the government and the BMA, the trade union for doctors, broke down in December. But the walkouts come at a cost. They're happening at a critical time of year when hospitals are especially busy dealing with the challenges of the cold season and with an NHS waiting list at a staggering 7.6 million. Over 1.3 million hospital appointments had to be rescheduled since the industrial action began over a year ago. And yet, the striking doctors continue to enjoy the support of over half of Britons.
The doctors say they're doing this to bring the government back to the negotiating table and to get it to recognize their value. They're also saying that feeling undervalued and being underpaid is pushing them to seek jobs abroad.
The BMA says 4 in 10 doctors plan to leave the NHS at the first opportunity. The government says it won't negotiate while the strikes are ongoing.
There's an overall focus on privatization, which means the health care insurance companies will be taking over many aspects of the running and resources of health. And that's led to record low wages, especially compared to a massive inflation and cost of living crisis, so that it no longer justifies the cost of training in terms of the actual remuneration. Medical students are leaving with medical school with £100,000 worth of debt, and they're not looking to pay that off for well over a decade. Whereas if they go to other countries simply next door, Ireland or Australia, they can immediately double their wage.
The British government seems nowhere near loosening its purse strings. But the consensus is that the longer these strikes grind on, the wider the damage. Saipur is up, London.
The summit of ECOWAS leaders, which ended in Abuja, the Nigerian capital, resolved that closure of air and land borders between ECOWAS countries and Niger is to be lifted in addition to other sanctions.
No-fly zone of all commercial flights to and from Niger is to be lifted. Suspension of all commercial and financial transactions between ECOWAS member states and Niger is to be lifted. Freezing of all service transactions, including utility services, is to be lifted. Freezing of assets of the Republic of Niger in ECOWAS central banks is to be lifted.
However, the ECOWAS meeting called for the ruling authority in Niger to provide an acceptable transition timetable to constitutional order. The ECOWAS leader said the decision to lift the sanctions was based on humanitarian considerations, especially as people are in the month of Lent and the holy month of Ramadan approaches. The meeting asked the three countries that exited the ECOWAS, that are Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali, to reconsider the decisions in view of the benefits the countries and their citizens enjoy in the regional bloc, especially the hundreds of millions of dollars of projects and programs, notably the Food Security Reserve. The ECOWAS leaders therefore urged the three member states that exited the regional body to resort to dialogue, negotiation and mediation to address their concerns.
The authority has also instructed the President of the Commission to invite Burkina Faso, Niger, Mali and Guinea to attend technical and consultative meetings of ECOWAS, as well as all security-related meetings.
The three West African countries exited the ECOWAS and established what they call the Sahel Alliance after ECOWAS resolved to condemn the military coups in the three countries and to impose sanctions on them. Experts believe that there are solutions in the medium and long terms for solving the crisis in the regional economic body.
The issues I mentioned earlier of pan-Africanism, of resource nationalism, of ensuring that people are carried along in decision-making processes, of ensuring that there is equitable distribution of resources, of ensuring that people have access to the good things of life, of ensuring that the dividends of governance is brought to the people must be addressed.
As one of the least developed regions in the world, the Sahel faces a multitude of challenges, including poverty, food security, poor governance and insecurity. Experts say some of these challenges are a matter of great concern, not just for the Sahel, but for the whole of Africa and beyond. They also noted that skillful diplomacy must be employed in addressing the exit of the three West African regions from the ECOWAS. Danjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
Iran Zamzam's company is poised to replace two major international soft drink brands in the region, driven by a growing boycott sentiment against Israeli army-associated products following the Gaza conflict. Having already entered markets in Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, and the UAE, the company aims to export 4 million cans of its popular soda to Kuwait, making a significant milestone in its expansion efforts.
My concept revolved around organizing a festival exclusively showcasing Iranian products. However, following the conflict in Gaza and the overwhelming positive feedback we received, we expanded our vision to encompass Turkish and Kuwaiti products as well. The event is spanned 2 months, during which we received numerous requests for an extension. Our primary objective at the society remains to spotlight Iranian, Kuwaiti, and Turkish goods, particularly as consumers are actively seeking alternatives to products associated with Israel.
Zamzam's growth in the Persian Gulf soft drink market is reinforced by its official replacement status for soda drinks in Kuwait alongside local brands like LC and Kenzo. The Iranian-Turkish festival organized by the biggest societies in Kuwait, Al Jabriya, has been instrumental in promoting Zamzam and other locally made alternatives as primary substitutes for boycotted products, significantly boosting Zamzam's popularity and market presence in Kuwait.
We're also operating as a retail seller, catering to the demand for products from Iran, Turkey, and Kuwait, which many customers have been requesting. While we understand that implementing boycotts can be challenging to achieve rapidly, it's not unattainable. Therefore, in response to the tragic events in Gaza, we've completely redirected our focus towards promoting locally made products through a campaign titled Support Us to Ice. The response has been phenomenal, with our sales soaring. Moreover, numerous other societies in Kuwait have chosen to follow suit and advocate exclusively for Iranian, Turkish, and locally produced goods.
The shift in consumer preference toward locally produced alternatives like Zamzam is emblematic of the broader economic repercussions of the conflict in Gaza. Major multinational corporations, including Starbucks, McDonald's, and Pepsi Cola, have experienced a significant decline in sales as consumers increasingly opt for products that align with their values and principles. As Zamzam continues to expand its footprint in the GCC countries, particularly in Kuwait, there is a shift in consumer behavior toward more regional products, and particularly the one from Iran, from other GCC countries, which is why the public in Kuwait is shifting into buying more products that are not associated in any way possible with the United States or Britain. This is Farah Al-Hashim, Kuwait City, from Al Jabriya area.
As the Pakistan Super League kicks off for its highly anticipated cricket matches, an unexpected controversy has emerged, leading to widespread calls for a boycott among Pakistani fans.
Oh, that is clear of all fielders.
The uproar stems from KFC's association as a sponsor of the tournament, with critics citing the fast food chain's American roots and linking it to the United States' support for Israel's onslaught on Gaza.
We condemned KFC as a sponsor of our national cricket event.
KFC represents a company with ties to Israel. Israel is involved in the killing of thousands of innocent men, women and children in Gaza.
Meanwhile, activists are pushing to boycott the event, urging fellow Pakistanis to refrain from attending matches in person and instead watch the games online from the comfort of their homes. The move not only expresses dissent, but also hits the tournament organizers where it hurts the most, their ticket sales and on-ground merchandise purchases.
I am part of the boycott movement because I believe it's important to stand up for the people of Gaza. By watching online, I am not contributing to the ticket sales or on the on-ground merchandise purchases, which are the main sources of revenue for the organizers. It's a way of hitting them where it hurts.
Usually we would go to the ground, but this year I think a lot of even cricket fanatics have chosen not to just because they want to boycott KFC as their main sponsor. But me personally, I've been skipping a lot of matches as well. We need to show solidarity for Gaza and stick with our brothers and sisters. I think that's more important.
Social media platforms have been flooded with hashtags such as #BoycottPSL and #NoToKFC as disillusioned fans express their discontent over what they perceive as an endorsement of American policies that they vehemently oppose.
The widespread boycott of an international cricket tournament by the passionate cricket-loving nation of Pakistan not only signals solidarity with the people of Gaza, but also serves as a powerful expression of discontent towards the businesses associated with the US and Israel. Nasik Azmi, Islamabad.
In yet another rally to support the Palestinians in Gaza Strip, thousands of Yemenis have filled the streets of the capital Sana'a and other major cities. They chanted slogans supporting Palestinian resistance and condemned the Arab world's indifference toward Israeli atrocities in Gaza.
The Yemeni people were raised since their childhood to love and adore Palestine and to love jihad in Palestine. Therefore, when the opportunity arose to have an influential position under the leadership of Ansarullah, they did not hesitate and went out to the streets, believing that their protests were jihad for the sake of God, as the least duty as long as the borders were not open for them, and they were not able to fight with the Palestinians.
A message to the European peoples. Your governments today are contributing to genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza by submitting to America's orders to militarize the Red Sea. America involves you in its own problems. The solution to stopping the Red Sea operations is to stop the aggression against Gaza and lift the siege. This is the easiest solution. But if your government wants to submit to America's orders, you will see what we will teach. You will see that we will teach America a lesson that will never forget. And if you attack us, you will unfortunately meet the same fate.
Protesters praised the recent operations by the Yemeni army, including the sinking of a British vessel in the Gulf of Aden. They also celebrated the introduction of the submarine weapon into the Yemeni army's arsenal, believing it will enhance the success of Yemen's naval operations.
The submarines introduced by Abdul Malik al-Houthi are one of the surprises that the enemy is going to face if it continues its aggression against Gaza. The Yemeni armed forces, specifically the Yemeni Navy, still have surprises coming, a wide range of targets, and also a superior ability to obtain information at any time and place. Therefore, these are successive military messages, the content of which is that we will escalate further as long as Israel's war in Gaza continues, and Yemen has the upper hand in its waters, and this position will never change.
Earlier, the spokesman of the Yemeni army announced that they have successfully carried out three military operations. The first operation involved launching multiple ballistic missiles and drones against various targets in Eilat-occupied Palestine. The other two attacks targeted an American destroyer and the British vessel Islander in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden. He added that the British ship was set on fire as a result of the attack.
Every Friday, people gather here affirming that they will never tire of taking to the streets to show support for the oppressed people of Palestine as long as the Israeli genocidal war on Gaza continues. They believe it is the least that all Muslims around the world should do as a religious duty toward the innocent civilians of Palestine. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The 15th of the month of Shaaban in the lunar calendar holds a special occasion for Shia Muslims. This day marks the birthday anniversary of their last Imam, Al-Mahdi. Shia Muslims around the world commemorate the day with great passion and unique traditions. In Afghanistan's Kabul, 28 couples from different provinces are being wedded in one big ceremony on this day.
Almost a decade has passed since our center started holding mass weddings. Back then, it was rare, but since then, it turned into a tradition. Now, many cultural centers have been holding mass weddings for up to 250 couples, as we have witnessed. Thank God, people have welcomed this culture. Although this culture has economic benefits for families, but the main goal of this tradition is to establish an Islamic wedding culture.
Muhammad is one of the grooms who decided to participate in this mass wedding on this blessed day and share his happiness with many others. He says this is a way to appreciate this blessed day.
Today is a day of happiness and joy for all of us. Regardless of getting married or not, today is our Eid, the day our Messiah was born. We celebrate this day by holding the most joyous and beautiful occasion of our life and hope God may hasten the return of our Messiah.
In a unique display of joy and solidarity, Shia Muslims have been holding these heartwarming traditions to celebrate the birthday anniversary of Imam al-Mahdi. But who is Imam al-Mahdi?
Imam Mahdi is the 12th Imam of Shia Muslims and the savior of the mankind as we believe. He went into occultation in the 1870s and will eventually reappear to establish peace and justice on earth. In this case, we have a common point with Christians. As the Prophet of Islam said, when Imam Mahdi returns, Jesus Christ will also return with him and assist him in the duty of establishing peace and justice on earth. At that time, all Muslims and Christians will unite when they see their saviors united.
This joyful mass wedding serves as a reminder of the strength found in shared joy. These mass weddings are a sight to behold. Today, numerous couples, filled with love and hope, embark on a new journey together. United in their joy, they share the anticipation for the blessed return of Imam Mahdi. Abdullah Mirzad of Kabul.
People laughing and chanting while enjoying the fireworks in illuminated streets. The mass celebrations are to mark the birth anniversary of Imam Mahdi, the 12th Imam of Shia Muslims, the prophesied Redeemer who is believed to bring peace and justice to the world.
Millions of Iranian people from all walks of life hold nationwide celebration every year for the birthday of Imam Mahdi, as well as praying for his arrival to bring peace and justice to the world.
Children, along with their families, are one of the main parts of the celebration. They talk about their love for Imam Mahdi and how happy they are on his birthday.
I'm here tonight to celebrate the birthday of our last Imam as we admire him so much. I want to share my happiness with my fellow Iranians out on the street. I also pray for his return.
But they have not forgotten the children in Gaza.
Imam Mahdi's return will bring peace and people will be living in justice and the war will stop. Israel cannot kill the Palestinian children anymore.
The war in the world will end. Israel will be destroyed. The US and UK atrocities will end as well.
We came here tonight with our family and with our child to show him that we are waiting for the celebration of the return of our Imam. And we are happy on his birthday.
Imam Mahdi was born in 869 AD in Iraq. According to historical scriptures, when he was born, his father hid him from the ruler of the time who sought to dispose of him. He is believed to be still living in occultation and will rise to rid the world of tyranny. Farzana Shuryun, Tehran.